Before we begin today's episode, I'd just like to let everybody know that we lost the most important member of Morbidology just before 3 p.m. on the 5th of December. My Staffordshire Bull Terrier, Louis, was helped across Rainbow Bridge at home with myself and my partner Joe by his side. As Morbidology listeners, you probably heard the patter of his feet, or even him snoozing in the background of some episodes. I never had the heart to close him out of the office when I recorded. To say that Louis made me a better person would be an understatement. He was the best boy, and a great ambassador for such a misunderstood and stigmatised breed. Rest easy, my big man. I'll miss and love you forever.
Once we found her body and we did the media release that Mrs. Graver's body had been recovered, we had students that were scared to death to attend class. We had teachers that didn't want to teach for concerns of their own safety.
Noema Graber had come from Mexico to Fairfield in Iowa, where she and her husband raised a family. As a devoted Spanish teacher, her sudden disappearance one November afternoon in 2021 left her students deeply troubled. As detectives began their investigation, a local resident came forward. He reported seeing two teenagers driving Noema's car after her disappearance. Noema Castillo was born on the 10th of November 1954 in Jalapa, Mexico, which is the capital state of Veracruz, around 180 miles east of Mexico City. Following her high school graduation, she spent 17 years working as a flight attendant in Mexico, yet she aspired for more significant achievements. Determined to realize her dreams, Noema pursued her passion for aviation, undergoing training to become one of Mexico's first female commercial airline pilots, breaking through traditional gender barriers. On the 4th of October 1986, Noema tied the knot with Paul Graber, who she had known since their teenage years. Following their marriage, Noema continued her successful trajectory in the airline industry, while Paul thrived as a consultant in Mexico City, utilizing his expertise to guide foreign enterprises through the intricacies of the Mexican bureaucracy. In 1991, the couple celebrated the arrival of their firstborn, Christian. The subsequent year marked the birth of their second son, Jared. However, driven by their desire to provide their children with a safer environment, free from the constraints of fortified windows, Noema and Paul made the decision to relocate from Mexico. Not too long after Jared was born, the family uprooted their lives and settled down in Fairfield, Iowa, Paul's hometown. Fairfield is a small town with a population of around 9,400 people, but it had a sizable foreign-born population compared to the rest of Iowa. 12.6% of the population is foreign-born, which is more than double the 5.3% of the general Iowa population. One of the contributing factors to this diversity was the presence of Maharishi International University. This is a private educational institution founded by the renowned Indian spiritual leader, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, back in 1971. The town has a vibrant Latino community, and Noema seamlessly integrated herself into the cultural fabric of Fairfield. Levering her multilingual abilities, she served as a mentor and guide to many within the community, offering support and guidance to those in need. A few years down the line, Noema and Paul welcomed their third child, a daughter who they named Noema Marie. The family home was one filled with love and compassion, but the familial bond extended beyond the home. The Graber family were active in St. Mary's Catholic Church. Noema, in particular, demonstrated her unwavering devotion by attending Mass every single day. She extended her hospitality to other churchgoers, providing solace through prayers and offering words of encouragement to those during their time of need. According to Father Nick Adams' recollections, Noema was celebrated for her exceptional kindness, boundless compassion, and unwavering faith. Noema always made sure to get involved in the church activities, and she sang in the church choir. She also assumed the crucial role of fostering a strong connection between the church and the burgeoning Latino community in Fairfield. Almost every single Latino family in the town knew Noema, and she became like extended family. It was rare to see a Latino family function, from a quinceañera to a birthday party, and not see Noema there. As the couple's children flew the nest, Noema found herself yearning for a transformative chapter in her own life. Seizing the opportunity, she pursued a degree in English and a teaching certification from Iowa Wesleyan University in Mount Pleasant, a bold step that she took in her 50s. She originally anticipated a career as an English teacher, but upon her graduation in 2006, she discovered a demand for Spanish teachers. Given her native fluency in the language, the role of a Spanish teacher appeared to be an ideal fit. Securing her first teaching position at Ottumwa High School, Noema dedicated her efforts there from 2006 until 2012. Subsequently, when a part-time teaching position surfaced at Fairfield High School, she eagerly accepted the opportunity, foreseeing the potential for it to transition into a full-time role. Noema's decision paid off, and she quickly integrated herself within the fabric of the high school, leaving an indelible mark on her students, their families, and the faculty alike. Her genuine aspiration for her students' personal growth was evident, and when students left the school, many sent her letters thanking her. She proudly displayed them in her classroom. During National Teacher Appreciation Week, one of her students dedicated a video to Noema.
Happy Teacher Appreciation Week, Mrs. Graber. Thank you for all that you do in and out of the classroom. We really appreciate how much fun we have in your class and how much Spanish we learn. And we just hope you have a really good day. Gracias.
Another student, Willow Larson, recollected. Her class was kind of hard at first, but she was a good teacher. She really pounded that stuff into your head so you would remember, and helped you with tests and stuff. Noema always made an effort to look out for her students as well. If one ever came in hungry or didn't appear to have warm clothing for the winter, Noema made sure that they were well fed and warm. She went the extra mile, making phone calls to community members to ask for help in connecting those in need with resources. Then in 2006, Noema and Paul decided to call it quits on their marriage, but it was on amicable terms. They still had a profound love for one another and were proud of the family they had created, but felt as though it was time to go their separate ways. The 2nd of November 2021 started out like just any other ordinary day for Noema. She took a group of her students to the town's library to appreciate a display commemorating the Day of the Dead, a Mexican holiday that honours and remembers deceased loved ones. While there, a news team happened to be present, and Noema remarked to the reporter, "We all know we're going to die. It's our way of laughing at death." Later, Noema and the students returned to their school, where they wrapped up their classes for the day. That same day, Paul was out of town for work. Despite the divorce, he and Noema still lived together, along with their son, Jared. Jared had been born with a severe genetic disorder, which meant that he couldn't live independently. As for Paul, his health wasn't in the best condition. He had endured more than 5 years of dialysis, which was the side effect of severe diabetes. Paul had also received a kidney transplant, and Noema was by his side every step of the way. The family bond was still strong, as if Noema and Paul had never divorced. Dinners were shared together, and the family liked to settle down in front of the television together after a hard day's work to watch a good show and chat. When Paul arrived back home the next morning, he was surprised to see that Noema's car wasn't parked in the driveway. He put his key in the lock and proceeded through the home, only to find that Noema wasn't there. At about 8:30 a.m. that morning, Paul received a phone call from the school, notifying him that Noema had failed to show up for her class. It had been scheduled to begin at 8:10 a.m, but Noema was a no-show, and she hadn't contacted the school to say that she was sick. This unusual behaviour was completely out of character for Noema, who was known for her unwavering punctuality and reliability. Overwhelmed by a growing sense of foreboding, Paul contacted the police to report his ex-wife as missing. The initial focus for the detectives was to determine the precise timeline of Noema's disappearance. They established that she had been at the school the day beforehand, as confirmed by the surveillance footage capturing her departing in her car. However, it remained unclear whether she had returned home or had driven elsewhere. Seeking to gain further insight into Noema's typical routine, detectives spoke more with her family. They revealed that Noema often went to Chautauqua Park after school. It was her routine to do 3 laps of the park before driving home before dinner. Acting on this information, the detectives directed their attention to the park. They considered the possibility that Noema might have encountered a health emergency or suffered an accident during her walk. However, upon arriving at the park, her vehicle was nowhere to be found in the parking lot. Undeterred, they meticulously combed through the park. On the path beside the surrounding woodland, Detective Trent Valletta noticed something on the ground.
Yeah, there was quite a bit of blood. Kind of starting around that area and then along the path up to the railroad tracks.
The detective had discovered blood on the park's northeastern perimeter, just beside a wooded area that led towards the train tracks. They decided to venture into the woodland. Down an embankment among the trees, detectives observed something unnatural to the landscape. It was a large pile of items, including a wheelbarrow and railroad ties, that stuck out amongst the trees and foliage. Detective Trent Valletta carefully began to disassemble the pile, uncovering a black tarp beneath. Peeling back a section of the tarp revealed Noema's lifeless body. She was cold to the touch with evident signs of a severe head injury, with blood marring her face and hair.
You can see pretty clearly that there's no visible injuries on the front of her body or legs or arms, maybe some scratches, that sort of thing from the woods, but nothing that would be fatal. However, when you look at her head, there looks like there's a very egregious injury there. It was pretty matted with blood, but you could tell that there had been a serious injury to her head.
Noema was also partially clothed.
She was just wearing a bra. Her pants were kind of down around her ankles. It was pretty easy. When we were standing there, we started looking around. We could see that, I think she had a turtleneck sweater was up in the trees, had been thrown up in the trees, and another shirt had been thrown up in the trees. They weren't well hidden, but she was partially nude.
Based on the blood evidence at the scene, it appeared as though Noema had first been attacked on the path. Detectives believe that she was then dragged into the forested area away from view, where she was ultimately killed by a heavy blow to the head with some kind of heavy object. The evidence also suggested that Noema's body had been moved with the wheelbarrow before it collapsed.
So the investigation showed several different times that a wheelbarrow was used to essentially transport the body of Noema Graver. It appeared that they didn't calculate weight and what the wheelbarrow could hold, so the wheelbarrow essentially came apart, broke apart, which is, I could only speculate that's why it was left there. It would not have been easy to carry out. But it was part of the plan to move her in that wheelbarrow.
The area was covered in crime scene tape as Noema's body was transported to the medical examiner's office. Dr. Michelle Cavalier was tasked with performing the autopsy. She determined that Noema had died from blunt force trauma to the head. News of Noema's murder quickly spread throughout the area, and the community grappled to make sense of the senseless nature of what had happened. Noema was a well-loved member of the community, who had been attacked while out for a routine walk around a public park in broad daylight. It struck fear into the residents all throughout the small town of Fairfield. Lieutenant Julie Kinsella recollected.
Once we found her body and we did the media release that Mrs. Graver's body had been recovered, we had students that were scared to death to attend class. We had teachers that didn't want to teach for the concerns of their own safety. It was such a concern to the point where the school shut down the schools. They obtained counselors, I think for 2.5 days, that they got out early, and then for like 2.5 days, there was no school. And then when the kids came back to school and teachers came back to school, there were counselors for both the teachers and the staff for the school.
Lori Knoll, the superintendent of Fairfield Community School District, expressed her condolences in a statement which read, "In her 9 years with Fairfield High School, Mrs. Graber touched the lives of many students, parents, and staff. We extend our deepest condolences to the family, friends, and loved ones of Mrs. Graber." The heinous nature of the crime led to some within the community questioning whether it might have been racially motivated. One of Noema's former students, Allison Reed, said, "While Mrs. Graber was bilingual and fluent in English, she did struggle with slang and had an accent. I know some students made fun of her for that." Such concerns reverberated within Iowa's Latino communities, prompting Joe Henry, the state political director of a Latino civil rights organization, to express apprehension that Noema's murder might have been indicative of a broader, unsettling trend. In a heartfelt tribute, Noema's ex-husband, Paul, said, "To know Noema was to love her. She was the kind of person every community longs to have in its midst, and we were blessed to have her in our lives." The outpouring of grief culminated in Fairfield High School organizing a candlelight vigil in Noema's honor, a testament to the enduring impact of her life and work within the community. Before the event began, fellow teacher Fred Huck played guitar and sang a song he had composed in Noema's memory. It was titled "A Light for Noema," and in the song he called on the community to heal. He sang, "While someone else sorts out who's to blame, it's our job to tend to the living just the same." As the vigil unfolded, those who knew and loved Noema stepped forward to share anecdotes and tributes, all underscoring her warm and welcoming nature. Maria Jimenez, in particular, expressed that Noema had seamlessly integrated herself into the fabric of the Hispanic community, endearing herself to each and every member who regarded her as an integral part of their extended family. Many in attendance were former students of Noema, some now navigating college, while others had settled into their own families and careers. The sheer magnitude of the candlelight vigil stood as a testament to the profound impact that Noema not only had on the lives of her students, but also on the entire community. As the tributes for Noema continued to pour in, detectives delved deeper into the mystery surrounding her murder. Their investigation led them to scrutinize surveillance footage obtained from Fairfield High School, the park where her lifeless body had been discovered. They were hoping to ascertain if anybody had followed Noema from the school, or if any suspicious vehicles or people had been lurking in the vicinity. The footage captured Noema leaving the school alone, heading to the park at about 4 p.m. Approximately 42 minutes later, her vehicle was seen leaving the park, but it wasn't Noema behind the wheel. Instead, two elusive figures that appeared to be teenage boys had taken control of her vehicle. A theory began to formulate that Noema had been killed by these two teenage boys, but their identities remained elusive due to the grainy nature of the surveillance footage. detectives embarked on a round of interviews with the residents living in the vicinity of the park. One eyewitness claimed to have seen two teenage boys hastily driving off in Noema's vehicle. Another report surfaced from a man who recounted a peculiar sighting the night before Noema's body was discovered. He had spotted a solitary teenage boy pushing a wheelbarrow in the direction of the park. It was a seemingly innocent sighting at the time, but now became significant in the wake of Noema's murder, as her body was concealed underneath a wheelbarrow. The detectives were determined to locate the pair of teenage boys, and they found their breakthrough in the form of a timely and promising tip. This episode is sponsored by Unfold Integral Coaching. Hey, how many things are you doing right now, listening to this podcast? That's one. Are you also driving, cooking, working out, scrolling through social media? And what's on your mind? All those unanswered texts, that looming deadline, that worry about that issue that won't go away. You've got a lot going on. In this crazy world, we all do. And we're losing touch with our natural ability for deep healing rest. That means most of us are living with a dysregulated nervous system that keeps us on edge during the day, wide awake at night, and snapping at the people we love the most. But here's the thing, you have the power to shift your body from fight or flight to rest and digest. And Christina Bonnet Acosta, a Stanford-educated integral coach, wants to teach you how for free. She's offering a no-cost 30-minute coaching session to 50 of 90,000 listeners for the holidays. You'll log out of Zoom feeling deeply relaxed and equipped with two proven techniques for finding calm in any chaos. Buddhist teacher Lama Pema Drakpa describes Christina as one of the most caring and insightful people he has ever encountered. And a past client said, "For me, every session with Christina has meant real, long-lasting transformation." So if you're tired of being held hostage by your own nervous system, grab your free session at www.christinabonnet.com. The link will be in the show notes before it goes back to its normal price of 65 euros. You're just 30 minutes away from finding flow in your body, mind, and life. That afternoon, a teenage boy named John Burnett appeared at the Fairfield Police Station. He said to the officer at the desk that he had information about Noema's murder. He was taken into a separate room, where he said that his 16-year-old friend, Jeremy Goodeal, had confessed to killing Noema over the messaging app Snapchat. In subsequent posts, Goodeal brazenly implicated another one of his friends, 16-year-old Willard Miller, stating that they had orchestrated the murder of Noema together. His digital trail unveiled a premeditated plot, with Goodeal detailing their elaborate planning leading up to the fateful day. As it emerged, both Goodeal and Miller had been students of Noema's, but it was Miller's plummeting grades that served as a catalyst to the murder. His bad grade in Spanish was damaging his GPA, and he decided that the only way to improve his grade was to get rid of his Spanish teacher. On the day of Noema's disappearance, she had a meeting with Miller in her classroom, unaware that he was already conspiring to kill her that afternoon. The two teenagers meticulously monitored Noema's routine, identifying Chautauqua Park as the prime location for their plot. It was relatively secluded and offered the perfect setting for the murder. They decided that they could quickly dispose of any evidence without interruption. After discussing his grades with Noema that afternoon, Miller proceeded to Chautauqua Park, where he met up with Goodeal. Armed with a baseball bat, the two boys patiently waited for Noema's arrival in the parking lot. Unaware of their presence, Noema strolled around the park, with Miller and Goodeal tailing her. Upon reaching a secluded area of the park adjacent to a wooded path that led to the train tracks, Goodeal approached her. He was wearing a mask, and he frightened Noema. He took the mask off, revealing to Noema that it was one of her students. She smiled at him, and he smiled back. Before she got the chance to say hello, Miller snuck up behind her and struck her on the head with the baseball bat. Subsequently, Miller and Goodeal hauled Noema into the woodland, where Goodeal too raised the bat and delivered another fatal blow. Once Noema lay lifeless, Miller and Goodeal stole some of her belongings, including her car keys and classroom keys. They drove away in her vehicle, eventually abandoning it on Middle Glasgow Road, which is a remote rural route. From here, Miller and Goodale walked on foot before they texted a friend named Habib Zain and asked him to collect them in his car. Much like John, Habib also spoke with detectives.
Yes, he told law enforcement that approximately 4:50 or so p.m. on November 2nd, he was contacted by Jeremy Goodale and asked for them to be picked up on Middle Glasgow Road. We were able then to find camera footage which corroborated what Mr. Zain said. It shows two males walking down the road and then Mr. Zain's car coming into a driveway to pick them up.
Following the Snapchat information from John, detectives swiftly located and apprehended Miller and Goodale. Miller was the initial suspect brought in for questioning at the police headquarters, where he was held without his mother's presence. He signed a juvenile waiver and was informed that the discussion pertained to his teacher, Noema. In the early stages of the interrogation, Miller referred to Noema as an asshole, citing her alleged unfair grading practices that adversely affected students' GPAs. When the conversation shifted to Noema's murder, Miller staunchly denied any involvement. Detectives then presented him with the incriminating evidence, refraining from revealing the Snapchat content at that moment. They informed him that he had been identified as one of the teenagers spotted in Noema's car post-murder, and also as the figure observed near midnight with a wheelbarrow. Confronted with the evidence, Miller altered his narrative, conceding that he was present during Noema's murder, but asserted that he wasn't involved. He claimed to have chanced upon a group of youths carrying Noema's lifeless body in the park. According to his account, when they noticed him, they coerced him into fetching a wheelbarrow to transport her and compelled him to take her van from the park. Detectives knew that this was false based on Goodale's Snapchat confession. When he was presented with this, Miller eventually admitted that he was there when the murder occurred. However, he distanced himself from the murder and claimed that it was Goodale who carried it out. According to Miller's account, he played a role in orchestrating the murder, but claimed to have merely served as a lookout while Goodale delivered the fatal blows to Noema. Miller admitted that initially, they had left Noema's body exposed in the woodland, only to later fear potential discovery. They decided to relocate the body, with Miller using a wheelbarrow from his home to conceal her remains beneath railroad ties and a tarp within the park. Simultaneously, detectives obtained search warrants for Miller's home. In his bedroom, they came across a baseball bat and blood-stained clothing. Furthermore, a search warrant for his computer revealed incriminating searches about the potential consequences for a student's grades if a teacher were to pass away or suffer severe injury during the term. In his bedroom, they discovered a baseball bat and blood-stained clothing. A search of his cell phone uncovered an ominous list, which had included items such as a baseball bat, hammer, knife, garden gloves, plastic gloves, trash bags, and wet wipes. As Miller was arrested following his interrogation, Goodale sat down and spoke with detectives. However, his version of events diverged from Miller's. While Miller attempted to distance himself from the murder, Goodale claimed full responsibility. He said that Miller had initiated the attack, while he had dealt the fatal second blow.
He kind of gave me like a nod, saying, like, here she comes. And I gave him the signal that it's all clear, and she walked by, and he hit her in the back of the head. And then I said, like, holy shit, make sure she's dead. So we hit her a couple more times. And then I dragged her off towards the access trail. Wasn't sure if she was alive or not, and I took the bat and I made sure she wasn't alive or breathing. And Chetty wasn't there at that moment. He was standing out on the trail, just making sure that nobody else is coming along.
Miller and Goodale were subsequently charged as adults with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. As per Iowa law, cases involving juveniles aged 14 and above can be transferred to adult court. Each of them were ordered to be detained on a $1 million bond, prompting Miller's defense attorneys to file a motion seeking a reduction. The defense argued that Miller had no prior criminal record or school disciplinary infractions, proposing that with a lowered bond, Miller would abide by GPS monitoring and remain under constant adult supervision. The prosecution opposed the motion, highlighting the severity of the charges against Miller and his numerous self-incriminating statements. They contended that no conditions of release could guarantee the safety of the community where Miller resided. Moreover, the prosecution deemed the suggestion of home supervision inadequate, citing that the crime had occurred while Miller was presumably under the supervision of his parents. On the 12th of November, both Miller and Goodale were formally indicted with first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder. They both pleaded not guilty to all of the charges against them, and both waived their right to a speedy trial. This meant the prosecutors wouldn't have to try them within 90 days of them being charged. Shortly thereafter, both Miller and Goodale's defense teams tried to get their bonds lowered in court. Goodale's defense attorney, Nicole Jensen, argued that her client had lived in Fairfield his entire life and said that his father, who worked in construction, could likely post $10,000 bond at most. She said that Goodale didn't have a passport or a driver's license, so didn't have the ability to flee from the prosecution even if he wanted to. Assistant Iowa Attorney General Scott Brown, however, argued that the bond should actually be increased to $2 million. He highlighted the extremely brutal nature of the murder, along with the evident planning that went into it as the reasons to warrant such a high bond. Judge Joel Yates ultimately denied the request to lower the bond, and it remained at $1 million cash only. When that failed, Miller's defense attorney requested that his client be tried as a juvenile instead of an adult. If the judge agreed and Miller were convicted as a juvenile, he could be released in less than 24 months. Goodale's defense attorney followed suit and requested that his case be transferred to juvenile court as well. While this was ongoing, both Goodale and Miller requested that all of their hearings remain closed. District Attorney Chauncey Moulding argued that they should be open and commented, "There are no secret murder trials in America." The judge rejected their request, which meant that the preceding court hearings would be open. Come April, Goodale attempted once more to have his case transferred to juvenile court, and his defense team appeared in court alongside the prosecution. They had hired psychologist Brenda Payne, who examined Goodale and reported he would benefit from juvenile court treatment and services. She said that she conducted several tests on Goodale and found that he was bright and had above-average problem-solving skills and no mental health issues. She diagnosed him with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which affected his impulse control and focus ability. According to Dr. Payne, juveniles with ADHD are very influenced by peers and have difficulty controlling their emotions. During her talk with Goodale, she said that he was grieving for all of the grief he had caused. She said that according to a recent study, a juvenile doesn't have a fully developed brain and doesn't have formed character or personality traits as somebody later in their life. In her opinion, Goodale would benefit from his case being moved on from adult court to juvenile court. Dr. Payne spoke about this in court, but she admitted she hadn't reviewed any police reports about the crime and had only reviewed the juvenile court officer's summary. She further admitted that there was no treatment or services in juvenile court for those who had committed such a crime that Goodale had committed. Assistant Jefferson County Attorney Patrick McGavin then asked whether Goodale was grieving for Noema, classmates, parents, or himself. He suggested that Goodale may have only felt grieved because he was caught and was now in custody facing an adult trial that could see him locked away for life. Even if Goodale could have been rehabilitated, he was only 8 months away from turning 18, and there was no way he could be rehabilitated in such a short time before he were released if his case was transferred to juvenile court. More and more people are interested in learning new languages, especially during the fall. Babbel is a great option if you want to start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks. which is perfect for showing off your skills during the holidays. Instead of spending a fortune on private tutors or using apps that just don't work well, Babbel offers short 10-minute lessons. These lessons are created by more than 150 language experts to help you learn quickly. I've personally used Babbel during my travels to Mallorca, and it helped me understand Spanish menus and arrange transportation easily. I could even chat with the locals. Here's a special limited-time deal for Morbidology listeners to get you started right now. Get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for Morbidology listeners, at babbel.com/morbidology. Get 55% off at babbel.com/morbidology. Spelled babbel.com/morbidology. Rules and restrictions may apply. While the judge was still making his decision, in May, Miller's defense team appeared in court and made the same request as Goodale's defense team to have the case moved to juvenile court. They hired psychologist Craig Rimpa, who testified that Miller was a different person he was now than in November, when the murder had happened, because of the rapid brain development that occurs in juveniles. He said the brain development in teenagers is significant because it affects the adolescent's decision-making, empathy, and knowing right from wrong. According to Dr. Rimpa, Miller was ripe for change, and said that if his case was moved to juvenile court, he could receive treatment and programming that would help develop these traits. He said that he had analysed Miller and found him to be kind with age-appropriate compassionate behaviour. He also found him to be impressionable, easily persuaded by others, and to be more of a follower than a leader. Again, the prosecution argued that Miller was so close to turning 18 that he wouldn't be rehabilitated in time for his release if his case were transferred to juvenile court. The judge ultimately denied both requests, which meant that both Miller and Goodale would be standing trial as adults. The judge said that there was limited time to rehabilitate either if they were tried as juveniles before their release. He wrote, "The juvenile court's dwindling time to rehabilitate is simply insufficient for a crime of such magnitude, based on the nature of the offences described in the minutes of testimony. This meant that if Miller and Goodale were convicted, they could be looking at a sentence of life in prison." Shortly after the decision, Miller requested that his trial be moved out of Jefferson County due to pre-trial publicity. The media interest in the case was high, and his defense team argued he would be unable to get a fair trial because of the extensive media coverage. The judge agreed, and Miller's trial was moved to Council Bluffs in western Iowa. Goodale followed suit, and his attorneys filed a motion for a change of venue. They argued that Goodale would be denied his constitutional right to an impartial trial if the case proceeded in Jefferson County because of the publicity. The judge agreed and moved his trial to Scott County. The case continued to meander through the justice system as the defense and prosecution were preparing for the two upcoming trials. In March of 2023, Goodale agreed to testify against Miller in his upcoming trial. On the 18th of April, however, both Miller and Goodale appeared at separate hearings, where they both changed their pleas to guilty. During his court appearance, Goodale provided a comprehensive confession regarding his involvement in the murder.
"On November 2nd of 2021, I met Willard Miller at Chautauqua Park. I understood that he had the intent to kill Mrs. Graber. Chaitin had brought a bat, among other supplies, to go through with the murder. And after he had struck Nohima Graber, we then moved her off of the trail, where I then struck her, and she died as a result. Afterwards, we removed any evidence that we could, and that was my recollection of the events on November 2nd.
"And you understood that Jason Miller had brought items to assist in the murder of William Graver via brought those items to the park within that day?
Correct. I didn't bring anything with me.
And he had previously asked you if you would assist him if he were to kill William Graver, and you agreed, correct?
Correct.
And just to clarify the record, and you've already made these statements under oath, but on November the 2nd, you observed Chayden Miller strike Mohima Graver first. Is that correct?
Correct. I was posted as a lookout while Chayden struck her in the back of the head with his bat.
And as we've discussed, you understood at that point you had participated in the planning. You were also culpable of what was going on. And upon seeing that Chayden's strike did not kill Ms. Graver, you also struck her to ensure that she had passed away. Is that correct?
Correct.
In contrast, during Miller's court hearing, he offered a contradictory version of events in an effort to distance himself from the murder. He contended that only Goodale had physically assaulted Nuima and maintained that he merely played the role of a lookout. His version of events was contradicted by Goodale. An assistant attorney general, Scott Brown, responded and said that there was evidence that both teenagers had struck her. He stated, "It was our intention at trial that the evidence would be that Mr. Miller planned the murder of Graber, and his plan was in place with Jeremy Goodale, and that they both acted as principals as well as aiders and abettors in the planning of the death of Nuima Graber. Tragically, Paul wasn't present to witness the conclusion of the case, as he had passed away just recently due to cancer. His brother Tom expressed that had Nuima still been alive, the cancer might have been diagnosed earlier.
Paul was deeply and understandably depressed by the murder of Nuima, and his life ended last week in the ravages of a metastatic cancer that would have been caught and treated far sooner had Nuima been there. I am certain, from knowing Nuima for more than 35 years, that she would have made Paul see the doctor much sooner for the new pains and skin lesions he began experiencing late last year. She would not have let him ignore these symptoms, and she would have insisted he get them checked. Instead, depressed as he was over this matter, over her murder, he delayed seeking treatment until the very end of March, and now is dead at the early age of 68.
Tom later commented, "We're glad the defendants have pleaded guilty. We're disappointed that one is not still owning up to his full role, but he has at least pleaded guilty, and we look forward to sentencing." With both Nuima and Paul gone, their eldest son, Christian, found himself the primary caregiver of his brother Jared. The sentencing phases were to follow, and Miller was the first to be sentenced. He appeared in court looking solemn on the 6th of July. The public gallery was filled with all of Nuima's loved ones. Her family, her friends, and even some students she had taught over the years. Assistant Iowa Attorney General Scott Brown stated, "This was a cruel, heinous act by two individuals. I cannot imagine anything really worse than to be attacked in the manner what she was. For what? A grade? This defendant deserves every day he gets in prison. Every single one." Miller was asked if he wanted to make a statement before his sentence was imposed. He stood before the microphone and said, "I would like to apologize for my actions. First and foremost to the family. I am sincerely sorry for the distress that I caused you and the devastation that I caused your family. I'm realizing just the magnitude of my actions. And I know it's wrong, and I knew it was wrong, and yet I still carried through. I still did what I did, and I accept responsibility for that." He then turned to the judge and asked that he be given a second chance at life.
"I apologize to all parties, everyone affected, to my community, to my family, to the Gravers, of course. And I ask that I'm and give it a chance. And I don't want to be institutionalized. I don't want to be in so long that I forget about, you know, what matters, where I come from, and what I need to do.
During the presentation of victim impact statements, Noema's brother-in-law, Tom, emotionally expressed.
This case has had an enormous impact on Noema's family, Fairfield High School, and the Fairfield community at large. Not only was Noema robbed of 30-some of the best years of her life, her murder deprived Paul Graber of the love of his life and certainly hastened Paul's own premature death. It has also had major impacts in the lives of their children, Christian, Jared, and Noema Marie.
Noema's son, Christian, also had some words to say.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to thank you all for giving me the moment to speak here. I want to keep this kind of short because I'd like to get home soon, but I want to talk to you directly, Shaden. I've got no hate in my heart for you, and I've met your mother on several occasions and we had good conversations. She seems like a decent woman, and I'll always treat her with kindness and respect. And I met your grandmother yesterday before the funeral of my father, and we had decent conversations. And I feel sorry for you. And I really feel sorry for your mother, your grandmother, and all your family. They seem like decent people, and I still think that there's potential for you to become a decent person as well. I don't see it at the moment, but I really hope that one day you can be.
During the sentencing, Judge Sean Showers addressed Miller, emphasizing that his actions were sinister and evil.
I find that your intent and actions were sinister and evil. Those acts resulted in the intentional loss of human life in a brutal fashion. There's no excuse. There is not a systemic societal problem that explains or justifies your actions.
While the prosecution had requested a minimum sentence of 30 years, the judge decided to exceed this recommendation, imposing a life sentence on Willard Miller with the possibility of parole after 35 years. In handing down the sentence, the judge said to him, "Your horrific actions led to the death of Noema Graber, and her family will never be able to fill that void." He further noted that he would have considered a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole if state law had permitted it. However, due to a 2016 law in Iowa that prohibited such sentences for juvenile defendants, the judge's hands were tied. Goodell returned to court to be sentenced for his role in the murder on the 16th of November. He wore a grey suit and took his respective place alongside his defence team for the proceedings. Goodell was asked whether he wanted to make a statement, and he confirmed that he did.
"I want to say I'm grateful for this chance to speak my piece. I offer my sincerest apologies to the Graber family, but I know my words will never be enough. I've had time to think on what to say, and I'm sorry, truly sorry. What I've taken can never be replaced. Every day I wish I could go back and stop myself, prevent this loss and this pain that I've caused everyone. Everyone in the community and outside of it, those closest to me and those closest to the Graber family, as well as the Graber family. I didn't know how taking Ms. Graber's life would affect you. I can't comprehend losing a loved one in such an awful way. I'm sorry I didn't stop this from happening in the first place. I'm understanding now that Ms. Graber meant so much to so many people. She was a support to the community and those close to her. And she was a caregiver to her family, to her children, and to her own husband.
After he read aloud his statement, his nose started to gush blood, which halted the proceedings for several moments until it stopped. Poignant victim impact statements were presented from Noema's loved ones again. Paul's brother Tom described how the murder had devastated the entire family and had hastened his brother's death. Tom said that Goodale sounded and looked remorseful, but still questioned the authenticity of his apology, stating, "I must say your actions to me undercut that. You're now an adult. You're over the age of 18, and yet you have your counsel to represent you, arguing on your behalf to escape punishment for this horrific crime. That doesn't sound like remorse to me." He was referring to the fact that Goodale's defence team were seeking a lenient sentence. As the statements were read aloud, Goodale struggled to maintain his composure and hold back his tears. Goodale's family also testified during the hearing, including his father, Dean. He spoke about his son's home life and how he survived as a single father after Goodale's mother abandoned them.
"How did COVID impact Jeremy's day-to-day routine?"
"You know, he was... You know, his mom kind of abandoned him."
"Hey, take your time."
"Interpersonal relationships were so important to him. And we spent 2.5 years in a global war against interpersonal interactions. It devastated him."
He then addressed Noema's family.
When this first happened, my first instinct was to reach out to the Graber family. Upon receiving advice from legal counsel, I was advised not to do that. I'm just so sorry. It's all I can get out."
"That's fine."
Jeremy Goodale was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole in 25 years. In announcing the sentence, Judge Schauer said that it was clear to him that Goodale was remorseful and didn't take into consideration the repercussions of killing Noema. However, he also noted that Goodale was a smart young man who could have easily stopped the murder from being carried out. The judge also wished Goodale good luck and said he hoped that everybody in the courtroom could eventually heal. Noema Graber had lived an eventful and fulfilling life, from making history as one of Mexico's first female commercial airline pilots to packing up and moving to a brand new country and taking on a brand new role as a teacher. A devoted mother, wife, and caregiver for her ex-husband and son, she extended her compassion to her students, harboring a sincere desire to enhance their academic success. Tragically, the culmination of her altruistic efforts took a devastating turn when one of her students repaid her kindness in the most unimaginable way. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Audra. If you'd like to join Morbidology up on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. In exchange for your support, I upload bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms. I also upload ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes, which includes bonus audio, video, and case files, and I also send out some cool merch. Morbidology is just a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way, and I am eternally grateful. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing podcast, Our True Crime Podcast. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Thank you. hear that jingle jingle? It could be Kris Kringle. Or a home invader coming down the chimney. A jilted lover flashing a knife under the mistletoe. Or a disgruntled coworker at the office Christmas party lacing the punch with arsenic.
It's disgusting.
Jen and Cam, the hosts of our true crime podcast, are always on Santa's nice list. But this holiday season, they're filling your stockings with 12 nightmarish crimes committed by the lowest scumbags on the naughty list.
It happened in Florida, so everybody's now going, oh.
They'll be coming down the chimney, counting down the 12 nights till Christmas.
Did I say it? 6?
4, 5, 7, 8, 9.
With a different true crime case every night, each one naughtier than the last.
This one is a doozy.
So spike your eggnog.
It's going to make you want to regurgitate.
Because you'll need it for our true crime podcast's 12 Nightmares Before Christmas. They're coming to town December 13th through 24th. Listen to our true crime podcast on your favorite podcast apps.
Well, I cannot wait. Hit me with it. Let's hear it. Dive right in.